begin the next issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine.
Here's an article from the October 1980 issue of Texas Monthly Magazine entitled "The Last Empire." The cattle are waiting. It is almost 2 o'clock at Marias, and the day's roundup is half over. T.O. and LaVoyager make one last ride through the herd, checking to see if any barren cows or yearling calves have been missed. Then the whole crew breaks for lunch. In a grove of mesquite and ebony trees, some canvas has been stretched over rough wooden tables. A side of beef, slaughtered that morning, hangs over a limb. The other half gives off the pungent smell of barbecue as it cooks over an open fire. The tables are suddenly laden with plates of ribs and sausage and sliced tenderloin, bowls of rice and beans, and platters of thin camp bread to be washed down with sweet tea. After lunch, the vaqueros bring the remainder of the herd out of the shade of the mesquite. The ground crew has dug a trench and built a fire of mesquite scraps in it. Branding irons have been stuck into the fire and their ends are already white hot. The family members loosen up the ropes and head into the herd to begin gathering the calves. Ed Durham, now 72 years old, ropes the first calf with a motion so simple as to escape the eye, and then drags it over to the fire. In the next instant, T.O., LaVoyager, Scott, and Martine all have calves on their ropes and are dragging them to the fire. The calves jump around on the ends of the ropes like 500-pound trout. The accuracy of the ropers on horseback is astonishing. They chase a loose calf at full speed through mesquite, twirling their ropes, then throw them deftly around the animal's hind foot or its head. Everyone is shouting in Spanish. Some of the ground crew run wildly around the calves, twirling their ropes over their heads and then looping them toward the flailing hind legs of a roped calf. When they succeed, they are dragged along the ground, trailing plumes of dust from the heels of their boots until the calf, now roped both head and foot, can be thrown onto its side and secured. The rest of the ground crew then run from calf to calf, applying three different brands, one for the pasture, one for the year, one the riding W of the ranch. Another man notches the ear, another gives a shot, and another paints the ear and the brands with white disinfectant, each in turn leaping over the calf he has just finished and heading for another one. Ropes attached to jumping calves sing through the air, sending the ground crew diving for the earth. The din is deafening. With each brand, a puff of smoke sizzles off the calf's hide. In the air is the smell of burning flesh, the same smell that seemed so appetizing at lunch. By 7 o'clock, the calves are branded, and the most dangerous work begins. Very carefully, the men start roping the big bulls, whose horns are starting to curl into their skulls and eyes. Then a vaquero with a hacksaw cuts off the horns. Halfway through, the saw turns red with blood. Finally, without warning or fanfare, there are no more cattle to be roped. The vaqueros prepare the herd for spraying with insecticide, and the Kleebergs begin dismounting and loading the horses on trailers. Their faces look like those of Welsh coal miners, blackened with dust. Their chaps are damp as sweat. The horses glisten. The riders walk with the tentative gait of people who have been on horseback for 12 hours, as if walking was an acquired and somewhat unfamiliar accomplishment. Off their horses, they look diminished. Only when mounted do they assume their full personality and stature. The horses seem to relax, too. They let out their urine in steaming streams. The paraphernalia of a cowboy's work, the spurs, the chaps, the bandanas, the saddles, bridles, and blankets are stowed away. Like props in a play, they no longer seem real. Tio takes Mr. San Pepe back to his corral. Today, this horse that brings a $3,000 stud fee has worked like any cowpony. Tio brings him some hay, and the stallion rolls in the dust of his pen, cleaning himself. That was a good day's work, Tio says matter-of-factly. At dinner in the Narias headquarters, the talk is dominated by good-natured kidding, particularly at the expense of Tio's younger brother, Scott. His horse, Showboy, had spooked, and bucking and kicking had carried Scott into the mesquite bushes. "Where'd you get that horse, anyway?" Scott asks Joe Stiles, after he has endured as much teasing as he can. "Oh, we just keep him around headquarters for the little girls to ride," Joe says. "Hey, Scott," says Martine Clement, getting serious, "why didn't you help me bring the horses down?" "I couldn't," Scott says. "I had to come down the night before." "Well, heck," Martine says. "I brought the horses down this morning, and I was still out to the herd before you were." Scott looks at his plate. This is exactly the sort of open criticism the family is constantly directing at each other. It wasn't a serious offense, coming to Narias early, but Martine wasn't going to let it pass. Then, the voyager, who came late to dinner, has his turn. He looks at Martine and says, "You left."
"I what?"
"You left. We hadn't finished spraying cattle and you left." Now Martine is on the defensive.
"I just left when the boss did," he replies, gesturing at Tio.
"Yeah, I know. The boss left early, too." Lavorger has made his point, and as a group, they have made another point. Any and all of them are fair game if they relax their standards, even for a minute. These young men are in their 20s or 30s. They are sitting around a table that was dominated, until a year or two ago, by men in their 50s, 60s, and 70s. There are ghosts everywhere. The almost mythic presence of Captain King and Henrietta. The sober determination of Robert Kleberg. The commanding brilliance of Bob Kleberg. And the still poignant memories of Dick Kleberg. All of those people who came before on this piece of earth shaped the destiny of the young men who now stand in their place. This new generation is the ranch now. They know it, and they are determined to be worthy. There isn't any drinking, and everyone is in bed well before midnight. In the morning, a new herd will be waiting.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the January issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note: this is real life, by Hunter Halk. In the grand scheme, it's only a number change on a calendar, but many of us attach significant hopes to the dawn of a new year. The holiday season and the onset of winter have allowed for greater personal reflection. Then comes decisive action when life's pace quickens once again in January. Eat healthier, work more effectively, seek out balance more often. All are promises we make to ourselves. For 2021, however, we'll tack on a few additional goals when the old ball drops over there in the Big Apple. We'll pay special mind to the health and livelihoods of our fellow citizens after an unprecedented year of hardships. We'll look ahead and try to be more involved in what happens to our country after another intensely bitter election season has drawn to a close. And, perhaps most crucial for our own well-being, we'll turn our attentions to people and pursuits that renew us, that remind us who we are behind the brave faces we put on each day. Authenticity is the watchword for this edition of CNI. On the cover, you see writer-director Taylor Sheridan, whose powerful works, among them Hell or High Water, Wind River, and Yellowstone, deal beautifully with the struggle between a hunger for power and a longing for connection. Sheridan captures the human condition in its rawest form, adding sweeping visuals and charged, moody scores to his modern Western stories. The work is unparalleled and the man behind it is so, so real. The same goes for the musicians, writers, podcasters, actors, and other figures we spotlight in The Real Deal. Throughout 2020, we've searched for deeper meaning in our entertainment choices. We've been drawn to people and makers with a vision, with something to sing and write about beyond hedonistic party tropes and glorified Dear John letters. As a lifetime music obsessive, I've found endless catharsis in the songs I've added weekly to our CNI-approved music playlist on Spotify. Compiling my latest list every Friday brings a trip down the rabbit holes of Americana, country, indigenous, and folk artistry. I've been moved and changed by the beautiful cries of Joanne Shenandoah's Coyote Song, the stoic yips of Coulter Wall's Cowpoke, the rugged wisdom of Charlie Crockett's Welcome to Hard Times, the emotional grit of Kaylee Hammock's Forged in the Fire. I could go on all day. With so much real deal music out there, the playlist now clocks in at more than 14 hours and growing. It's free for the listener. Just search CNI approved at cowboysindians.com. Whether you find it in music, movies, books, or other pastimes and activities, authenticity is more important than ever. That includes the personal space where we've all been spending increasing amounts of our time. You can find plenty of inspiration for making your shelter your sanctuary in this issue. As you ramp up for another calendar year, eat, drink, watch, read, connect, and find ways to be merry. Right now is all we have. Make the most of it. Here's a travel article entitled, A Ranch for All Seasons. At Middle Creek Ranch, outside of Steamboat Springs, Colorado, heaven includes a well-appointed guest cabin, private chef, activity-filled days, star-filled nights, and 10,000 acres all to yourself. By Wendy Wilkinson. Driving onto the massive Middle Creek Ranch is like entering a western wonderland. The gravel road that cuts through the 10,000 plus acres takes you past herds of grazing buffalo, cattle, and a horse facility with almost 24 very well cared for horses. The name comes from the creek formed by the convergence of three strongly flowing streams, the Little Middle, the Middle, and the North Fork. Nestled in Oak Creek, outside of Steamboat Springs, in Colorado's rich and fertile Yampa River Valley, the private and rentable ranch boasts Rocky Mountain beauty and a welcoming ranch compound reached at the end of the 4.6-mile drive. We're greeted by the property managers who show us to our two-bedroom, with a loft, log guest cabin. No scrimping on amenities here. From the freshly cut wildflowers on the front porch and kitchen counter, to the fridge stocked with cold beverages, to the Turkish towels and Egyptian cotton bedding. After we settle in for a bit, we get the grand tour in an open-air four-wheeler. One of the remarkable things about Middle Creek is the number of ecosystems on the Canyon Rich Ranch, from giant pine trees and tall aspens to acres of dense 6-foot-tall ferns that call to mind Jurassic Park. After a 3-hour tour, we return to the main lodge for a gourmet meal that the chef has prepared for us. After dinner, we almost rally for a soak in the hot tub, but we're just too contented right where we sit. The rest of the evening consists of rocking on the front porch, gazing into a star-filled sky, and listening to nothing but the quiet. After all the fresh air and with no light pollution sneaking in the windows, we sleep like babies. We wake up and ready ourselves for a hike, managing just a tiny fraction of the property on foot before we head off on an adventure we didn't even know was on our bucket list. We learn firsthand what caking the buffalo is all about as the ranch manager feeds 100 head of enthusiastic bison supplements near the open jeep where we sit slack-jawed and camera happy. One of the young calves seems to be thinking about jumping into the front seat with me. Nothing could be more magnificently removed from my normal day-to-day. Next, we're off to the barn where several of the horses are being brushed and then saddled, soon to be mounted by three female cowboys who will be riding out on the property to head off several head of cattle that have escaped from the herd. Then comes a fly fishing lesson. After several tries, I cast the fly deep into the center of the stocked pond, and although I don't catch anything, I feel truly alive in my own "a river runs through it" moment. Our heavenly time at Middle Creek Ranch passes way too quickly, even as it seems to slow down to a delightfully languid pace that really lets us savor the moments and connect with nature. Luckily, we can come back. Up to now, the ranch has been entirely private, but has recently opened for week-long retreats and celebrations for guests to rent out the whole 10,000 acres. The luxury price tag includes the spacious main house and two guest cabins. Altogether, they sleep 18 or more, as well as the lodge, a private chef for the week, and all ranch amenities, including shooting at the gun range, horseback riding, bicycling, four-wheeler tours, fly fishing, hiking, and use of the swimming hole with private deck. And don't forget, caking the buffalo. Stays at Middle Creek Ranch can be arranged through Explore Ranches, a private land experiential travel company that connects travelers with wild and scenic private properties and connects landowners with guides, musicians, program providers, archaeologists, astronomers, culinary experts, and other immersive travel outfitters. For more information and to see Explore Ranches' portfolio of properties, visit exploreranches.com. Bear Pascoe's second dream. When he retired from the NFL, this Super Bowl-winning tight end immediately started working toward his next goal, a rodeo championship. By Michael J. Mooney. Bear Pascoe knew he had not played well in his last preseason game. The journeyman tight end only had a few weeks to learn the complex New England Patriots offense, so he understood there was a chance he'd get cut again. When he saw someone from the team's front office making his way around the locker room the morning after his bad game, Pascoe started packing up his stuff. His career as a professional football player was over. That was 2016. And by then, Pascoe, who's 6'5" and north of 260 pounds, had been cut by four other teams. Originally drafted in the 6th round out of California State University, Fresno, by the San Francisco 49ers in 2009, he was waived before his first season started. Pascoe signed with the New York Giants and played there for the better part of five seasons, including in Super Bowl 46, when he caught four passes in a 21-17 victory over the Patriots. But then he'd bounced around the league for a few years. He played a season in Atlanta, then signed a one-year deal with Chicago before getting cut at the end of training camp. He signed with the Detroit Lions and played a few games with them at the end of the 2015 season. Pasco remembers the New England coaches wishing him well, then putting him on a plane heading home to the central coast of California within a few hours. That night, he was in his father-in-law's rodeo arena wrestling steer with local college kids. "I always knew when I was done with football, I'd dive into rodeo," Pasco says. "So when I saw them practicing, I just put my boots on and joined them." By then, he'd been married to his wife Katie for 3 years, but they'd been together for 7. He says early on in their relationship, he told her that he had 2 dreams in life: winning a Super Bowl and winning a National Finals Rodeo steer wrestling title. Now he's working on that second dream. On the day we talk, Pasco has been working at his wife's family's ranch near San Luis Obispo. He woke up early this morning to feed the horses and clean some horse pens. Then he pushed a heavy trencher through a pasture where he wants to add a sprinkler line. From the highest point on the property, you can see the nearby beach and ocean. But Pasco doesn't go down there often. Most of his time is spent here, working and practicing. He grew up not far away, the son of a ranch foreman in California's Central Valley. His given name is McKenna, but people have called him Bear most of his life. He had chores to do each morning before he went to school. Then came chores when he got home each afternoon. "My childhood wasn't any different than any ranch kid," he says. "Working hard right next to grown men, learning how to work really hard. That gave me the work ethic to succeed on the football field. When he was a boy, he competed in local team roping events, but as he grew bigger and stronger, he knew playing football would get him a college scholarship. He played quarterback in high school and switched to tight end at Fresno State, where he still holds records for both most touchdown receptions in a game and most field goals blocked in a career. He played 85 games as a pro, regularly battling future Hall of Fame linebackers and defensive ends. None of it came easy, but he studied tape relentlessly, practiced hard consistently, and persisted even when he faced major career setbacks. Meanwhile, rodeo was always in the back of his mind. When his NFL days were done, Pasco turned to his father-in-law, John W. Jones, Jr., for coaching. Both Jones and his father, J.W. Jones, are rodeo legends and world champion steer wrestlers. Pasco started working his ground game, his technique in the arena. A few months later, in early 2017, the former tight end jumped his first steer, and he took a rough tumble. By his 3rd or 4th attempt, though, Pasco was able to catch the steer and throw him down. By the end of that year, he was competing in rodeos. The next year, he entered more, even winning an event in Reno, Nevada, with a $95,220 purse. He says that, like football, steer wrestling comes down to technique. As valuable as his size and strength might be, bulldogging is more about style and instinct in the moment. You get out there and trust that technique to take over. Of course, in football practice, you can slow down a play. A coach can walk a player through a block or a route step by step, then drill those motions over and over until the whole thing becomes ingrained, second nature. You can't do that with a live steer. You can't ask a steer to stand still as you figure out the best way to turn its head, Pasco says. The mental preparation is also similar. You know that the work period leading up to that point, you've done everything you can, Pasco says. So you can just go out there and react. Go have fun with it. As with his football career, there have been setbacks in his pursuit of a steer wrestling championship. Plenty of rodeos where he took chances didn't pay off. And just like he did in his football career, Pasco has persevered. He says his wife, a champion barrel racer herself, is his biggest fan, and his father-in-law keeps him focused. Johnny is good about reminding me not to overthink things, Pasco says. He keeps everything simple. Pasco knows that not everything will go his way. Cowboying, like so many other things in life, takes work. There are no shortcuts to success. So, after talking for an hour or so about his journey from ranch kid to Super Bowl champion to professional steer wrestler, Pasco has to go. He has more horse pens to clean. Here's an adventure article entitled Sky King. When Texas native Kirby Chambliss isn't at home on his Flying Crown Ranch in Arizona, the world champion aerobatic and air race pilot is cowboying it up and upside down in the wild blue yonder. By Tony Reagan. Kirby Chambliss does most of his flying with his feet on the ground. Back when the native Texan was a world champion pilot in the Red Bull Air Race, before the series abruptly folded after the 2019 season, Chambliss believed that each race was won or lost long before takeoff. Now that he's back to aerobatics full-time, back to swooping and diving and pushing planes to their limits above the grandstands full of awestruck air show goers, Chambliss, 61, still believes it's all in his head. I try to visualize every aspect, every sequence, every fraction of a second, he says. I want to visualize from the ground what is going to look like for those people in the stands. That's what really has helped me to win. For instance, before a 2018 race at Texas Motor Speedway in Fort Worth, at the back of the Team Chambliss hangar, one of Chambliss's tech-savvy crew members had set up a state-of-the-art flight simulator that could virtually take pilot Chambliss through every twist and turn of the race course and mimic the power, speed, and agility of Chambliss's Edge 450 V3 aerobatic aircraft. It could replicate the conditions and pressures he'd put the plane through on his runs. The program could even account for the wind, but Chambliss wasn't having any of it. The simulator is a pinball machine, he said, loud enough so his technicians could hear. I'm open to anything. I know I can't fly by the seat of my pants anymore. I'll listen to the guys, but I don't always follow what they say. He'd listen to about 10% of what we say, said Paulo Escold, the team tactician, after overhearing. Paulo has spent hours poring over data, trying to translate instrument and computer readings into applicable advice for Chambliss to take up in the air. Actually, it's more like 5%. I can't follow them blindly, Chambliss said. If they put the wrong numbers in, I'll be flying the wrong way. Instead, Chambliss walked past the simulator over to a crude model of the race course he had laid out himself in the corner of the hangar, using cans of Red Bull to represent the 82-foot inflatable pylons that create the gates he'd fly between and around on the slalom-like course. With his hand laid palm down on his imaginary plane, Chambliss instead walked through his flight path, drawing on decades of experience and the rough calculations of his mind. Chambliss calibrated that mental simulator through years spent soaring through wide open skies of southeast Texas. Born in Corpus Christi, Chambliss has been drawn to the skies since he can remember. His dad, a private pilot, led a pajama-clad Chambliss tag along in the ride seat of a Cessna when he was just 5. Chambliss helped his father build his own plane out of sheet metal before he was a teenager, and he had a job cleaning restrooms and fueling aircraft at a small regional airport all through high school. When Chambliss got his first gig behind the controls of a corporate jet at age 21, his bosses told him he should take some remedial courses in aerobatics in case of an emergency. They told me, "What happens if the jet ends up upside down?" Chambliss said. When the young pilot first experienced the thrill of rolls, spins, and dives of aerobatics, he was hooked. "From that moment on, I could care less about flying straight up. Now I'm flying in 3D. The only limit is my imagination." After 5 years of imagination and work flying for Southwest Airlines, where at age 24 he became the company's youngest ever pilot, Chambliss bought his own aerobatic plane, a Pitts special biplane, in 1983. By 1997, he was a member of the U.S. National Aerobatic Team. He was eventually named team captain and went on to win 5 national championships and 13 medals at the World Championships, including the 2000 men's freestyle world title. In 2003, Peter Bisenyi, a Hungarian-born fellow aerobatics world champion, contacted Chambliss about joining the new Red Bull Air Race, a series of races in which the globe's top pilots would steer their monoplanes through daunting courses of gates, turns, and chicanes set up all over Europe, Asia, Australia, and North and South America, trying to best each other's times. The high speeds and stunts at low altitudes appealed to the daredevil in Chambliss. "We used to drag our wings in the dirt," he said. "It was a lot of fun." Chambliss finished on the podium in each of the first 4 seasons, including 2 series championships. But as the sport grew in popularity, safety became more of an issue. More rules were added, including a floor of no less than 30 feet above the ground. Still, Chambliss remained competitive, finishing 4th as recently as 2017. In the process, between the air race and the aerobatics, Chambliss had logged more than 27,000 hours in the air, more than twice the total of most of his competitors in the adjacent hangars at Texas Motor Speedway that day. "We have a saying about the difference between 10,000 hours and 5,000, he says. "It just means you've seen it twice." The veteran might have made light of his tenure in the cockpit, but he and his crew knew that vast experience would be an asset against competitors half his age who might have relied too much on the technology and less on the feel of the stick in hand. Team Chambliss crew chief Jason Risop said that they often prayed for wind and rain. "We do well in crazy weather," Risop said. "He can adapt on the fly. No one drives the edge better than him." Team Chambliss took 3rd place that day to the delight of the crowd in his home state, and he finished 6th for the season. The next year, which turned out to be the Red Bull Ace race's last, he took 2nd in the series finale in Chiba, Japan. The only Red Bull Air Racer to compete in every season, he finished his Red Bull Air Race career with 2 championships, 2004 and 2006, and 3rd on the all-time wins list with 10. When the Globetrotting Series folded, Chambliss returned to the American West, where he now gets to spend most of his time. He owns the Flying Crown Ranch in Arizona, where he lives with his pilot wife Kelly and daughter Carly. With no outlet for his competitive edge, he instead expresses himself through the aerobatics he performs at air shows all over the world. This is Chambliss as artist, the plane his brush, the sky his canvas. He wants to paint the audience a picture that they've never seen before, moves that even Chambliss has only seen in his own mind. "If I can leave a fan saying, 'I've never seen a plane do that before,' that means everything to me," Chambliss says. "The only limitation is my imagination." The Songs That Rebuilt Tom Douglas. When he made the leap from an unwavering real estate career to the uncharted waters of country songwriting at 39, it went something like this. By Allison Bonagurl. When Tom Douglas walked over to the piano in his Dallas home in 1992, he essentially walked away from a lucrative career as a real estate broker. And in the nearly 30 years since, we've all been the better for it. How did a guy selling real estate for years go to a grand piano on a beautiful Saturday morning with a black and white composition book and a good cup of coffee and finally decide to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Douglas, now near 68, asked during a one-man show in 2019 at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta. This is that storyteller's story. Even with a family to support, Douglas was brave enough to pursue a career in songwriting long after lesser writers might have abandoned that dream. "Mine is a story of failure," Douglas shared. "It seems unfair that at 39, jaded and incredibly cynical about my life, Almighty God looks down and says, 'Your past is not your poison, it's your gift,'" the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Famer opined. Douglas defines his failure thusly. He had originally given songwriting a shot when he was fresh out of grad school and moved to Nashville to play the coffee shop circuit. But the dream took a back seat as Douglas's responsibilities as a father and son became more complicated. In addition to a growing family, he and his wife raised three children, he needed to help care for his ailing father. He left the Nashville life behind and moved to Dallas to pursue a more stable career in real estate brokerage. He continued his new path for 39 years after moving away from songwriting. But that day in 92, at his piano, Douglas penned Little Rock, a tune that ultimately became his first chart topper, sung by Colin Ray, and moved him back to Nashville and into the kinds of writing sessions that generate hit after hit. And at the aforementioned Atlanta show, armed with nothing more than a grand piano, a harmonica, and a microphone, Douglas played the song that brought him back, along with a small fraction of the 2,500 songs he's written since. There was Little Rock, the most salient song from the first chapter of Douglas's second career, then Lady Antebellum's I Run to You, Chris Jansen's Drunk Girl, Tim McCraw's Grown Men Don't Cry, Celine Dion's Recovering, and McGraw's Southern Voice, a song Douglas explained was notable because I was able to put Apalachiola and cicadas in the chorus, and there's not another song in history of the world that did that. Then, of course, there was his Grammy-winning song for Miranda Lambert, The House That Built Me, which was recently named the Academy of Country Music's first song of the decade. But not unlike his own career, that song had to spend some time on simmer before anyone gave it a shot. He told the song's story and how it almost never even made it to Lambert. Douglas's co-writer, Alan Shamblin, came to him one morning in 2002 when they were performing in Sundance, Utah, and said, "I've been thinking about how houses hold memories. But what if there was a song not about the houses that we build, but the houses that build us?" The idea was so powerful, Douglas said, that he begged Shamblin not to utter those words to another soul until they got back home. "When we put our first draft together, it was 10 minutes long. We made a demo of it, turned it in, and the publisher's response was, 'Cool.' which in Nashville is code for "We will never, ever listen to that song again." We were crushed, but undaunted. Every so often we'd tweak it, he said. Then finally, in 2009, we printed off voluminous lyrics and we got down to the essence. We needed a setup line for the hook. We needed, "If I can just come in, I swear I'll leave and won't take nothing but a memory from the house that built me." Between 2010 and 2011, the house that built me won both the CMA and ACM Song of the Year awards, and Lambert took home a Grammy for her vocal performance. Last year, legendary singer Tanya Tucker put her own spin on the tune. Douglas admits that these days he still spends his life following the songs, and he has no regrets about leaving his past career behind, because that leap of faith he took 28 years ago never sounded so good. Silence is olden. Before talkies, westerns were all tumbleweeds, train robberies, and lost treasures. By David Hofstede. For an art form that disappeared nearly 100 years ago, it's remarkable how silent films have retained a loyal following among movie buffs. They still air almost every Sunday night on Turner Classic Movies, and continue to find new audiences with restored editions on DVD and Blu-ray. Westerns were there from the very beginning. The Great Train Robbery was released in 1903, just 9 years after the invention of the technology that made moving pictures possible. With just 14 scenes, a budget of $150, and a running time of 12 minutes, The Great Train Robbery was one of the first movies to establish the rules of cinematic storytelling, such as editing individual shots and scenes together to advance the story, and crosscuts to present two different events happening simultaneously. The film was a huge success and played continuously for years in the first movie theaters. The first talking feature, The Jazz Singer, came out in 1927, and the game changed forever. By then, almost 11,000 silent feature movies had been produced in America. Fewer than 3,000 features exist in some complete form today, about 900 of them westerns. As the novelty of moving pictures evolved into feature films, westerns remained one of the most popular genres. Here are seven classics from the silent era that can still captivate a modern audience. The Battle of Elder Gulch, 1913. At just under 30 minutes, this is the shortest film on the list, but it must be included because of the talent involved in its production. Mae Marsh and Lillian Gish play sisters living on the frontier. The director was D.W. Griffith, one of the titans of early cinema and the first filmmaker to craft exciting action sequences, such as the scenes where the sisters and their fellow settlers are rescued from an Indian attack by the U.S. cavalry. The Squaw Man, 1914. Several sources list this frontier drama as the first feature-length film made in Hollywood. It returned $245,000 on a $15,000 investment and launched the careers of director Cecil B. DeMille, Jesse L. Lasky, later a co-founder of Paramount Pictures, and Samuel Goldwyn, the G in MGM. The actress playing an Indian maiden who falls for a English nobleman was billed as Red Wing, and she was the first Native American movie star. The Covered Wagon, 1923. The first epic western. The Covered Wagon assembled a cast of more than 1,500, One Utah newspaper account of the time reported that the film sought 1,000 white men and women, 600 Indians, 150 yoke of cattle, 300 covered wagons, and 900 horses and mules, with 100 actors and 50 crew coming in from Hollywood besides. Look closely at the faces of the pioneers as they set out on their perilous journey west. Years earlier, many of them had actually been part of an actual wagon train taking them to a new life. The film was so successful that Will Rogers filmed a parody version called Two Wagons, Both Covered, in which the pioneers reach California and are greeted by real estate developers. The Iron Horse, 1924. No director is more closely associated with classic westerns than John Ford. This was his first feature-length western hit, a nearly two-and-a-half-hour magnum opus about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. According to silent film historian David Keen of the Niles S&A Silent Film Museum in Fremont, California, the first filming took place in Mexico for the cattle drive, and more in New Mexico. A scene was filmed south of Santa Clarita, California, at Beale's Cut, an old pass through the mountains. The bulk of the filming was done near Dodge, Nevada, for a month, and a scene was shot in Wadsworth, Nevada. The train being hauled through the snow was done in Truckee, California. There were 300 cast and crew, 300 Paiute Indians, 30 Chinese, some Paiutes doubled as Chinese, and 500 people for the Golden Spike scene. Tumbleweeds, 1925. This landmark film stars one of the screen's first Western heroes, William S. Hart. Some of the film industry considered Hart a has-been after his preceding pictures had flopped, and studios were tired of his insistence on presenting an authentic look at the West and its cowboys. By then, audiences seemed to prefer flashier Western stars like Tom Mix. But United Artists convinced him to return for one more picture, Tumbleweeds. It tells the story of the closing of the frontier and served as an ideal elegy for its star. The thrilling land rush scene on Oklahoma's Cherokee Strip would even thrill kids raised on Star Wars sequels and Marvel superheroes. The Devil Horse, 1926. Before Silver, Trigger, and Champion, there was Rex the Wonder Horse, a black Morgan stallion that became a big box office draw in the silent era. Supposedly, the spirited horse had killed one of his handlers. Was it true, or a studio story to boost publicity? Either way, audiences loved watching this feisty four-legged hero chase and corner bad guys and even stomp a few into their just deserts. The Devil Horse also stars Yakima Canutt, the famed rodeo cowboy turned stuntman who doubled John Wayne in Stagecoach. The Winning of Barbara Worth, 1926. A list of Gary Cooper's iconic Western roles should include this film right alongside The Virginian and High Noon. Though he came to the cast as a replacement for Monty Blue, critics thought Cooper, as local cowboy Abe Lee vying for the love of Barbara, stole the picture from stars Ronald Coleman and Vilma Bankey, then considered the movie's most romantic couple. It is best remembered now for a still impressive special effects sequence in which a bursting dam unleashes a torrent of water that floods a small town. Here are a couple of articles from the section we call the Real West. All hat, no sound. Tom Mix was the silent screen's king of the cowboys, by Mike Kopuk. On the south side of town, in Oklahoma's former territorial capital of Guthrie, there's a building that once housed the Blue Bell Bar. Founded in 1889 in the wake of the land rush, it was one of Guthrie's most popular watering holes. But the saloon's main claim to fame might have less to do with its genesis and more to do with a certain one-time bartender. Before he found fame in Hollywood, the Blue Bell is where future Western silent movie star Tom Mix once poured drinks for real outlaws, real frontier marshals, and real gunfighters. A rumor goes around that on the east wall of the saloon once hung a life-size chart of Mix mapping the locations of 12 gunshot wounds and dozens more other bodily injuries from knife fights and broken bones he had sustained during his days as a cowhand and rodeo rider, and as an actor doing his own stunts as one of the top male movie stars of the silent film era. The Pennsylvania-born Mix had drifted west into Oklahoma territory, working on the 101 ranch alongside Will Rogers, breaking horses and herding cattle. He had ended up in Oklahoma in 1902 after marrying his first wife, Grace Allen, that year. She didn't like his being in the service, so he went AWOL and they headed out west to escape the army. After leaving the Blue Bell and Guthrie, Mix turned up next as a performer in the 101 Ranch Wild West Show, where he debuted in 1905, dazzling audiences with his horsemanship and shooting skills. The birthplace of the show was the Miller Brothers 101 Ranch, a cattle operation that worked 110,000 acres in the Indian Territory of Oklahoma, and put on yearly rodeo extravaganzas that eventually expanded into the widely traveled Wild West Show. In its debut year, the show drew close to 80,000 attendees, with attractions that included Apache prisoner Geronimo, Buffalo Bill Cody, Bill Pickett, and Mix. That same year, probably due to his connection with the 101 Ranch Wild West Show, Mix rode in Theodore Roosevelt's inaugural parade with a cavalcade of Western cowboys. He continued amassing cowboy cred and resume lengtheners by winning national rodeo championships for riding and roping in 1909 and 1910. In 1910, Mix was asked to appear in the documentary Ranch Life in the Great Southwest. The film was a financial hit and launched a movie career that would ultimately boast some 366 westerns full of flashy stunts, fist fights, and shootouts that left audiences wanting more. You might say he was John Wayne before there was a John Wayne. Mix seemed suited to on-screen fiction, and storytelling was in his blood. In real life, he was something of a fabulist. "He was the goddamnedest liar who ever lived," declared famed rodeo cowboy turned Hollywood stuntman Yakima Canutt. "But never did he lie to hurt anybody. It was always done in showmanship." Mix became the star of the Saturday afternoon matinees, in which the hero wore a white hat, kissed his horse, drank only sarsaparilla, and rescued women from a fate worse than death. If the plots were formulaic, his stunts weren't. His westerns stood out for death-defying exploits that saw Mix and his horse, Tony, leaping through glass windows and over deep gorges. The stunts kept his audiences enthralled. Mix, meanwhile, suffered mounting injuries. But the silent action suited Mix. His voice had been affected by a gunshot wound of the throat during his day's cowboying and from having his nose broken multiple times in bar fights. His films quickly made Mix one of the highest paid actors in Hollywood, and he cut quite the famous figure off screen as well. Flamboyantly dressed in his white 10-gallon hat decorated boots and a body-length coat. He had his initials lit up in neon lights on his ranch house outside of Los Angeles. His style and wealth were extravagant, and so were his marriages, 5 in a 30-year span. As the silent era came to a close, Mix was getting old, and his style of westerns had passed. When he asked friend John Ford for work, the famed director told him audiences now wanted something different. For a while, Mix found circuses lucrative. He made his last feature, the 15-chapter serial The Miracle Rider, in 1935. 5 years later, at age 60, he filled a custom aluminum briefcase-style suitcase with money, traveler's checks, and jewels, set it on the back seat of his yellow supercharged 1937 Cord 812 Phaeton convertible coupe, with an externally mounted spare tire on the rear deck, one of only two made. The other reportedly belonged to film legend Barbara Stanwyck, and headed east to visit old friends. 18 miles south of Florence, Arizona, he came up to barriers at a bridge washed out by flooding. Swerving twice, he finally overturned in a gully. The case flew forward, striking Mix from behind, breaking his neck, and killing him. Had it been a horse and not a car, and had the good guy survived, it would have been an ending fit for the motion pictures. You can find the case that killed him at the Tom Mix Museum, not in Guthrie, but in Dewey, Oklahoma, where Mix lived with his third wife, and where the museum has an 8.5 by 11 inch version of the chart showing his many and much mythologized gunshot wounds and other injuries.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by the coronavirus update at 1.
That's it. Listen, I have had enough. I have
had enough of what?
I am going back to my mother.
As we look back on this difficult year, one debate stands above all else. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? This week, Recording Library of West Texas Radio's series of movies set around Christmas continues with Die Hard.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
We thank you one and all and wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
It's Christmas Eve in L.A. But a team of terrorists.
You want money? What kind of terrorists are you?
Who said we were terrorists?
Have their own holiday plans.
And I'm telling you, you're just going to have to kill me.
Okay. We do it the hard way.
But the one thing they didn't plan on was New York cop John McClane.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?
Yippee-ki-yay, mother...
And humanity!
They have already killed one hostage.
This channel is reserved for emergency calls only.
Lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Come to Papa, honey.
Are you really an American?
Only if New Jersey counts.
What does he think he's doing?
Good job.
Here's the artillery on us.
Good idea. It's not the police.
He's an easy guy to like.
Welcome to the party, pal.
And a hard man to kill. Bruce Willis. Die Hard.
The audio described Die Hard. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 12 noon.
It's time for the Noon Book Hour. Readings of books from all genres, handpicked by staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Tom Jowers for the Georgia Radio Reading Service. This is the eighth and final episode of Hercule Poirot's Christmas, written by Agatha Christie. I'm going to go back just a little bit to bring you up to date from our last reading. Hercule Poirot leaned forward. The two most valuable clues in this case were uttered quite unconsciously by two different people. The first was when Mrs. Alfred Lee quoted a line from Macbeth. Who would have thought the old man to have had so much blood in him? The other was a phrase uttered by Tressilian the butler. He described how he felt dazed and things seemed to be happening that had happened before. It was a very simple occurrence that gave him that strange feeling. He heard a ring at the bell and went to open the door to find Harry Lee, and the next day he did the same thing to Stephen Farr. Now why did he have that feeling? Look at Harry Lee and Stephen Farr, and you will see why. They are astoundingly alike. That is why opening the door to Stephen Farr was just like opening the door to Harry Lee. It might also have been the same man standing there. And then only today, Tressilian mentioned that he was